Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Live from My Drum Room. I have a very special show today celebrating the 70th birthday of the great Jeff Beccaro, one of my absolute biggest heroes. And joining me on the show is my dear friend Robin Flans, who is the author of this new Jeff Beccaro book, Moments in Time, Jeff Beccaro Stories, available through Hudson Music. And in fact, it's on sale all this week on Hudson Music's website. And you might recall she also authored this book in 2020. It's About Time, Jeff Beccaro, The Man and His Music, another fabulous book by Robin and also available through Hudson Music. But a really special part of this is the legendary producer Gary Katz also joined us for this episode. This was kind of a last minute thing. I wasn't sure if Gary was going to be able to join us, so I didn't announce it ahead of time, you know, for the live show. But sure enough, Gary jumped on a few minutes into the episode, as you'll see. I'd never met him before. I was so honored to meet him and to have him on the show and have him share some stories about Jeff. As you probably know, Gary is the man that produced all those big Steely Dan records from the 70s into the early 80s, as well as some other records. He knew Jeff very well and shared some wonderful stories about the great Jeff Beccaro. So come along for the ride. Fasten your seatbelt, as we say. I really think you're going to love this. I also stuck in a bunch of my favorite Jeff Beccaro songs. So I hope you enjoy this. I know you're going to enjoy this. I'll see you on the other side. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. So please welcome, here with me now, my dear friend Robin Flans.
Hi.
Robin. Hi, Robin.
It's good to see you, John. And if I might say a couple of things right off the bat.
Please, yes.
First, I want to send out my love, my heart, and my thoughts to the Beccaro family today, all his loved ones. I know... All of these days, I mean, every day, I'm sure, is hard for them. All the loss, I can't even imagine. And they have handled it with such grace and outpouring of warmth towards everyone. But today is a big one, as Jolene put it on Facebook, Jeff's 70th. My God, he should still be here. I send my love to them. And off topic a little bit, I want to say congratulations to you on your milestone viewership. You should be proud. You're doing such great things, and it's such a service to everyone in the music industry. And we've been good friends for so many years, and I adore you, and thank you for having me today.
So thank you so much, Robin. And the feeling is so mutual, you know that. And likewise, I have so much love and respect for you. And I will say that, you know, I'm taking a page out of your book, really, in terms of what you've been doing for drummers for as long as I can remember. Before I knew you, before I'd ever met you, when I was reading all those beautiful interviews in Modern Drummer that you did. I mean, you were the one, you know, with all due respect to all the people that worked for Modern Drummer in those days, you got the best out of all these drummers. Your ability to, especially Jeff, you could feel it.
Thank you. I'm proud of my work with Modern Drummer, because I feel that I did get some good interviews with some great people, and I maintained great friendships with many of those people. I mean, I'm so honored to have worked for, I don't know, close to 40 years for that magazine. And I loved every minute of it.
And we did too. We all did too. Everybody that read those articles and interviews did too. And I have to tell you, you know, we needless to say, we have many, many people watching today for this show. And thank you for making it so special for me, because, you know, I would have loved to have done something to talk about Jeff on his 70th, but having you here really just, you know, makes it.
Well, it's not about me. It's not, I haven't brought those people because of me. I've brought those people because of Jeffrey. Just like everybody says, congratulations on the book. It's, if it weren't about Jeff, there'd be no people buying it. So I have no false ideas.
Well, you brought all these great stories to life. And I just have to say, our dear friend Jody Cortez is watching. And aww. I'm going to like lead off. I think I noted it in the book. There's a great, and needless to say, we've known Jody forever. I've known Jody as long as I've known you, 35 years. And I love him. And I love you, Jody. And over the years, whenever I'd see him, he'd always have a Jeff story. He'd always reminisce about how he grew up in the Porcaro family. And the great story that he tells in the book, where it's in here somewhere, where he went to see Jeff play, and it was double drums with him and Jim Gordon. And they're standing.
Oh God, yeah.
Do you remember that story? Jody, I hope I don't botch this. I've got it right here. Jody Cortez, Jim Gordon story. And so I ran into the restroom, standing at the urinal, and in walked Jeff and Jim Gordon. And they stand next to me. Jeffrey's to my right. Jim Gordon is to his right. And I go to Jeff. Jeff, you're the best drummer in the whole world, man. And he goes, no, he's the best drummer in the world. So our heads all turn to the right and look up at Jim Gordon.
It's such an image, right? I mean, what an image, the two of them, all three at the urinal.
Yes, yes. And I would tell you, you know, I can tell you, speaking personally, men tend to have these conversations in urinals, you know, and
really?
I'm going off topic slightly, but 10 years ago when Hal Blaine was honored at the NAMM Tech, whatever it is called, the award ceremony that NAMM does, they honored Hal, and Jim Keltner and Chad Smith were presenting the award to Hal. And somehow we all ended up in the men's room together. And Don Randy, before it started, we all decided we should visit the men's room before the festivities. So it's just, and then as we came out, someone took a picture of all of us as we all stepped out of the men's room, like standing there, you know, and it was
priceless.
I remember thinking, like, we're all in the bathroom. I don't know.
It's
this is
great.
Maybe
maybe. No, it's great. It's great. It's perfect. I mean, not the same with women. So it's very funny.
It is. There's nothing dirty about it. I'm just saying it's just
funny. It's humorous.
Yeah, it is. And I saw that Stanley Sheldon, our friend Stanley Sheldon, is also watching. And Stanley, of course, is in the book.
Hi, guys.
Yeah. So Robin, let me just jump in here and say, so everybody, and me especially, love this book that you wrote 4 years ago. It's About Time. And I think you said something at the time that you weren't quite finished, but I think at the same time, you maybe weren't excited to, you maybe needed to take a break. You weren't ready to.
No, I thought I was finished.
You did. Okay.
No, I really thought that was it, or I would have written more. But, and it's happening again, John. I mean, since this book came out, and there are no plans, trust me, but I'm so frustrated because people are messaging me and saying, oh, I was this and that for Toto. I did this, I did that, and Jeff was this and that, and here's my story. Mm-hmm. And I'm so frustrated. Why didn't I know this? Why, after the first book, didn't they message me and tell me this story so I could have included it in this book? And now I have a new collection. I'm pulling my hair out. Seriously.
I understand. I understand.
This book, I mean, I ended up with a whole chapter on Jeff with double drums, because I hadn't realized, and what I've told people is, and maybe they didn't read the post, but what you don't understand is that when Jeff was here, there was no internet. anything that I knew about Jeff and his work had to come from either a silly little press release from the record company, which was not detailed. It was probably about the current project that Toto was working on, or it had to come from Jeff's mouth. And Jeff didn't talk that much about the details of his work. He certainly didn't boast about it. He certainly didn't, if it was a project-related interview, say about Toto 4, that's what he talked about. So I never knew the details of his playing world. I didn't know to ask him about his double drumming.
Yeah.
And then came the internet. And shit! All this wealth of information opened up to me. And I'm so angry at him for not having shared all of this stuff with me.
Well, maybe. First of all, I want to tell you that our surprise guest is in the waiting room.
I'm gonna double drums because.
Okay, I'm gonna let you introduce him.
Something to do with that right off the bat on one of the albums. This giant produced on Jeffrey. He is a legend. He produced Steely Dan and many albums that had Jeffrey on it. He became, I want to say, Jeffrey became his favorite drummer, but I don't want to take words and put them in this man's mouth, but he became, and I said it in my thank yous in this current book, the greatest gift Jeffrey left me. And he's none other than the legendary Gary Katz. He honored me with the foreword to this current book. And trust me, it wasn't easy to get him to do it. But not because he didn't want to, but because he was overwhelmed by the task. But he pulled it off, and it's a beautiful thing.
It is beautiful.
So, oh, there he is!
And there he is.
Hello, guys.
Gary Katz, what an honor, man. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, that's okay. Robin's an old friend, and Jeffrey's an even older friend.
Wow.
Gary, we're not really old friends. We're just really new soulmates.
Call it what you will. I've known Robin for quite a while, and Jeffrey as well.
Wow. Well, this is incredible. Thank you for being here. We were just saying, the foreword that you wrote in the book was just so beautiful. And what I love about what you've written in this book, Gary, and not just the foreword, but even throughout all the different times you're mentioned in here and the stories you tell, you really paint a picture. You bring him to life. It's the best way I can describe it, through how well you knew him and obviously how much you loved him. Can I ask, when do you recall being the first time you met Jeff?
Jeff and David came out to Cherokee Ranch because we were having a problem getting a track we liked for the song Night by Night. And Denny Diaz, who was one of our guitar players, said, oh, I know a couple. Well, actually, he said, I know a couple of guys. So Jeffrey and David came out one night around midnight and they played Night by Night. That was the first time I met Jeffrey.
And that album, that's what I was talking about, has Jeff and Jim Gordon.
Yes, Jim Gordon played that record. Jim played most of the album.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, I don't know what to say about Jim. He was a fabulous musician. And as far as I knew, a great guy. Obviously, yeah. There are other issues.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. Yeah.
I have a good friend, Mike Ruggiello, who's a big fan of yours and was wondering in your hint last week whether I was going to be on the show, but he's a big fan.
Yes, and Mike is watching and he says hello to you.
I'm sure he is. Hi, Mike.
He's a great guy. He's an old friend from, gosh, we've known each other since we were kids.
Yeah, you know him longer than I do, but we've gotten to know each other. I like him a lot.
He's a great guy. And also your friend Rob Wallace is watching and says hello.
Oh, cool.
And he's making a reference to the Yankees, which being a Red Sox fan.
Well,
I'm
you
not
can tell him he can take his Yankees, turn the sound down a little, bend over, and enjoy his day.
So that's how it goes. Okay, I get it.
Well,
so Gary, so you met Jeff and David Page during that session.
They came out and helped us get that track we needed, and you know they were just so great. There was nothing to say.
Yeah,
Gary, what was your first impression of Jeff's playing? Why did you fall in love with him?
I don't know. Honestly, I couldn't tell you that. It just happened, and I was very fortunate to be able to work with most of the great drummers in America over the years. You know, Jim and Purdy and Keltner and Jeffrey and I just became friends. So I loved working with Jeffrey. We for one thing, Jeffrey's greatest gift is he knew how to make a record. Not just that he could play, but he could hear the record as he was playing the drums and there was hardly any other music. It's a gift. And the great drummers know how to play knowing they're making a record.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate? What does that mean?
He was great at that.
What does that mean?
It means he heard the song. But let's say it's Donald for a minute. Donald would, you know, scratch a vocal while the guys were playing. And Jeffrey knew where to put the fills and where to just play a groove. And so that at the end of the day, he heard that record before it was made. As great drummers do. But he just had a really great knack. And he and I, you know, we just connected in the studio.
You know, Gary, it's interesting you say that because that's a kind of a consistent theme in the book that yourself and other, you know, Lee Ritenour, there's a bunch of, you know, other legendary musicians that are quoted in Robin's book that say essentially the same thing you're saying, that he had that ability to, I guess, kind of almost be like a producer in a sense, right? Where he kind of had an overall idea of how the song is going to
shape. David and Jeffrey had the benefit of having fathers who were great musicians.
Yeah.
And as we were growing up, you know, you learned, if no other way, even by osmosis. But with Jeffrey, Joe was not by osmosis. Joe showed Jeffrey what the story was.
So the first Steely Dan record that Jeff did for you was
Pretzel Logic.
Okay. Yeah.
He played Night by Night.
Yeah. And was that 74?
You're asking the wrong person.
Okay. Yeah. I'm always intrigued at just how the amount of work he was already doing by the time he was like 20. You know,
when we went to Europe and I took Jeffrey, Joe and Aileen had to sign a permission slip because he wasn't 18.
Wow. Okay. Wow. Okay. Yeah.
And they should have, right? Because he was quite a little mischief maker.
He was a hot shot in the valley. He was a valley boy. He and David and Lukather and Landau and all these guys, young, you know, guys who grew up in the valley, were great musicians, and they, you know, they interchange with each other. You could have used Landau and not Luke, or you could have used Luke and not Lee. I mean, it just was a collection of great musicians at the time.
But I'm talking about on a personal level. There's that story in the first book about the first night in the hotel. You were in
that was good.
Hotel.
Well, so when we went to London, my first time in London also, but it was arranged. So the band stayed at one hotel and Donald Walter and I and our sound guy, an oddball Scotsman called Dinky Dawson, who was fabulous. We stayed at another hotel, I guess you might say a better hotel. And it was 3 a.m. and we were just sitting in a room, the four of us, you know, lamenting the trip we just took and thrilled to be in London for the first time. And there was a knock at the door at about, you know, literally 3:30. And Jeffrey was standing there with his bag saying, "Where are the bitches?" So we figured that was good enough and we let him stay at the hotel too.
He was wise beyond his years. Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure. There were a lot of adjectives he could have used. That might be one.
but it really was a case. Again, it's you know, and I know this about him anyway. Even, but it's so often mentioned in Robin's book how, you know, the level that he was. He, you know, so many people say that even when he, like you said, Gary, when he was 18. He was a pro. I mean, he was a real pro, not pro from the standpoint of getting paid money, but he just knew shit that a lot of guys didn't figure out till they were in their 20s.
Like I said, he and David had the benefit of having very successful parents in the business they wanted to be in, and it was a great asset for both of them.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, David's father was, you know, he was the deal.
Yeah, yeah.
Marty Page. Marty Page is the deal. And David's a fabulous, he's a great, great musician.
Absolutely, man. And having worked with him as much as you did, Gary, I mean, his work ethic is pretty, Jeff's work ethic is pretty legendary, right? I mean, he came to work. Yeah.
He came to work. And he wasn't going to leave till he knew it was what we wanted. He knew what we wanted. When we weren't working and he had nothing to do, he would come to the studio and fall asleep on the couch just listening. And he was always around. And, you know, we worked with good people and he took advantage of being around it. You know, he I won't say idolized, but he was very appreciative of being able to be around Purdy. And Jim and obviously, you know, Keltner and Keltner took him under his wing when he was very young. And he just had the advantage of being around the good stuff much younger than other guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
To your point, John, there's a story in the new book from a guy, a composer and producer named Randy Edelman, who worked, you know him, Gary?
Well, I have a good Randy Edelman story.
But he worked on, he got a call to arrange Jim Nabors on the Sonny and Cher show.
Yeah.
And he didn't think that anyone would be able to do this, the drum part. And he was shocked to find out that this little putz, he went back to see who it was that executed his arrangement flawlessly. And it was a little putz, this little 17-year-old person. And he went up to him and he hugged him. He couldn't believe that this guy had done this right from the start, all the way through, without a mistake.
Jeffrey knew much more than he did. But when our contract was up with ABC, Clive called me, who I knew for a while. And he said, can I get a chance to talk to Donald and Walter? I said, sure. I called Donald. I said, so Clive called. He wants to talk. He said, hey, listen, let's take a trip home. And, you know, it's on his dime. And, yeah, sure, no problem. So we did. And we walked in the office, you know, and I introduced Donald and Walter to Clive. And he's talking. He didn't talk for more than a minute. He said, wait a minute, I want to play you something. And he played some thing of Randy Edelman's he was working on. He was Randy. I think he was Randy Edelman's father. Because you couldn't have done more for a person than Clive tried to. So that was fine. And then we talked for another 3 minutes. He said, wait, I got something. And he played another Randy Edelman track. Wasn't particularly the music I liked or particularly cared for, nor anyone else in the room except Clive. And so he went on. He must have played us 3-4 tracks. Then he took us to lunch. When we came back from lunch, he said, you know, I'm not finished. I really want you to. And he played us another couple of Randy tracks.
Oh, God.
And had nothing much more to say. He didn't make any offer. Or not that I expected, but it was just, I like Clive. He has always been very nice to me. But it was a useless meeting except lunch and a trip home. And as we were leaving, he gave us each a signed copy of his book. And when we went back to the hotel, Donald told me he took out the Bible from the hotel and he put the book in.
But
so whenever I hear Randy Edelman, I think of that.
If that was Randy Edelman's solo album, I think that was Jeff on drums.
It might have been. I have no idea. It's the only reference I have of Randy Edelman.
Because
it's not
of
negative
that,
or anything, I don't know him.
Because of that Sonny and Cher thing, Randy hired him on his solo album.
And he did the right thing. He's not going to get anything much better, so I don't blame him.
Maybe that's why Clive liked it. That's a very funny.
That is great, yeah.
So we took our books and went home.
That's so funny.
And Gary, I think I know the answer to this question, so excuse me if it's kind of a dumb question, but you know, I don't hear a lot of people talking about how great a reader Jeff was, but obviously he could read because.
But that's from his father.
Yeah.
Just like David. I mean, they were brought up.
Yeah.
Joe, apart from playing, gave lessons.
Yeah.
He was a very difficult teacher. I know people who were taught by him and left. Just he was very tough.
Yeah.
So you can only imagine how he was with Jeffrey.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Jeffrey knew how to read when he was 7. Seriously.
Yeah.
So did David. That's why, you know, when they went around as a team, you know, it was hard to believe that these young punks could do what they did, but they were so far advanced to all these other guys because of, you know, Marty and Joe.
Yeah. And I think it's,
Jeff always said he wasn't a reader, but you know.
Oh, no. He read.
Yeah.
He couldn't do what he did. We only knew one guy in our circle who we still questioned whether he could read, but it actually didn't matter to us. But Hugh McCracken, my really good friend, may he rest in peace. We always questioned whether he could read, but Donald Walter would say he plays jingles all day. He has to read. And so I would say, yeah, you know, I guess so. But when we would do dates, I could see Huey listening to Jeffrey or Purdy or whatever, or who was ever playing, and he would sit next to his amp in the room. The amp was barely audible, and he would, you know, nitpick a part. So we never knew whether he could read, and to this day, but I can't imagine he couldn't, and Jeffrey was a reader before he was 10.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think it was just Jeff's humility, you know, like when he used to talk about how he couldn't play a shuffle.
Yeah.
Humility was a bunch of bullshit. He knew exactly what he could do. And my story about Black Friday, you know, that was the shuffle story.
Yeah.
So that was just Jeffrey being, you know, get Purdy. He plays fucking shuffles, not me. And then he went in and he played Black Friday with his hand in a cast.
Yeah. Right. Right. I know. I know. And I've heard the same thing, Robin. You know, I've heard him say maybe during one of your interviews where he claimed he wasn't a very good reader. And I thought, you know, just as a not knowing him well, thinking like, well, man, how could he do what he does if he you know, playing with Steely Dan, you have to be able to read.
Well, you didn't really have to be able to read. We didn't write charts, except for Asia, which was a freak of nature the way it came out.
Yeah.
We didn't have charts. We had chord charts. So the guys didn't really have to read. And, you know, like I said, Jeffrey could read when he was a kid.
Mm.
But we didn't write charts. Rarely ever, certainly not for the rhythm section.
Okay, that's good
to know.
Charts,
and Chuck would say to Walter, how do you want me to play this F sharp and whatever? But it wasn't a chart. It was just a matter of Chuck asking Walter what he really preferred. Paul Griffin never asked Donald a question. Purdy never asked anybody a question. And even Jeffrey. You know, we loved these guys, not just because they were great. We didn't have to say anything. If we had to tell them, we had the wrong band. We weren't as good as these guys.
Yeah.
So we hired the guys who knew how to do it.
Can you share a story, Gary? Another Jeffrey story, a Steely Dan story? The Black Friday story is legendary, obviously, with his hand in a cast, but while I have you here,
I know most of the stories, but I don't know, you know, as we talk story, you know, situations come to mind. I'm not a really good historical recounter as such, rather than responding to the conversation we're having.
I got you. Okay. Fair enough. Fair enough. I don't want to put you on the spot.
No, you can put me on the spot. I'll sit here for too long trying to think of something.
And some of the other artists that you produced, you hired Jeffrey to play with as well.
Jeffrey, you know, I knew that night I'd leave with a track I liked every night. I never had a day I didn't get a track that I used in life.
Yeah, I'm going to just flip through the book real quick here. Sorry, I didn't. There's, to your point, though, I was just going to point out this Greg Bissonette story in the book that kind of exemplifies what you were talking about, Gary, which is he had just learned the Rosanna beat, 1982, and Greg's on a gig, I guess, and Joe is there as well. And he says to Joe, hey, check this out. And he's playing the Rosanna beat. And I knew Joe pretty well myself, you know, and it's just like you said, he kind of said to Greg, yeah, it's pretty good. It's pretty good, you know. Like
pretty close, I think.
Pretty close, Jerry, yeah. I'm sure you've watched his Rosanna instructional video.
Yes,
but that's what it was like.
Yeah,
He wasn't any different on that video than it was in the studio. Although he didn't talk, he just played. I never gave him any idea about what to play, except that he always played in a position where he and I could look at each other, and we did communicate during a take things I know he understood.
Yeah. And he worked pretty quickly in terms of number of takes. He could get what you needed.
Well, Steely Dan didn't.
Jeffrey, we, you know, the stories about, you know, doing 100 takes or whatever, it's just not true, except for one track that Jeffrey, Chuck, and I did after Donald and Walter said, fuck this is not going to work. And I didn't want to, it was Gaucho, and it was one of my favorite songs and still is.
Yes.
I said, no, we're not going to lose this song. And so they left in a, you know, sort of hit, you know, sarcastically leaving and saying, we're going home. If you get the track, call me.
Yeah.
So Jeffrey and Chuck, who's my very close friend as well, the three of us stayed and we did, I had a chart. That was a night we had a chart. We made a chart and he would play. Chuck was there so he could play for Jeffrey and Jeffrey would play. And when I heard good bars, I would mark them on the chart until like 3-4 in the morning. And then Roger Nichols, who was unprecedented as an editor. We did about 58 edits of the takes through the night. And I called Donald. I said, all right, come back. And they unbelievably said, yeah, it's great. And they left.
It's a great story. Yeah.
It's a really good story. It's my absolutely the best work I've ever done was that night with Jeffrey and Chuck.
Wow. Bravo, Gary. Yeah,
That was good. That was a good night. And Jeffrey was, that's what made, you know, to me and, you know, our relationship so special. He wasn't going to leave till we had that track either.
But, Gary, you did a lot of other work with Jeffrey, Dan.
Yeah.
And him to do it.
Pardon me?
You picked him to do it.
Most of the time. There were, you know, I worked with Jim,
mm-hmm.
and I worked with Purdy a lot. Painful as it is sometimes. But I do work with, I mean, I've done lots of tracks with Purdy, and he's a very good friend.
Mm.
And so I'd say Purdy and Jeffrey did most of the tracks I did. You know, Jim played occasionally.
Rick Murata?
And every time Jim played or Murata, I would say, why don't they play more for us? Especially Jim, whose work I'm just in awe of every time. And he played the best fill we had on a Steely album. And I'm going to say this, and if Jim hears this, don't take offense. I mean it with a smile. But I always felt that the track would go, and every once in a while, Jim might not remember exactly where in the track we were. Please forgive me, Jim. I don't mean this. But when we were doing Josie, we got to the end of the solo. And I have always thought that he didn't remember that we needed a fill there to go back to the chorus. So he started it late and had to finish it quickly to get to the downbeat. And he's a genius.
So you thought it was an accident?
Oh, no. Nothing any of those guys played were accidents. You can't play like that accidentally. He just remembered he needed a fill and he had to rush it. And the rushing made it fabulous. It's our best fill on any record.
Is it that fill where he does that little stuttery? Yeah.
Yeah, and then finishes it.
It's unbelievable.
It's great to play with musicians that are that great. That's all. Jeffrey being right there with all of them.
Yeah. But the other projects you worked with, the non-Steely projects that you worked with Jeff on, what were some of the ones?
You're going to have to tell me. Honestly, I don't remember. Like Rosie, my friend Jimmy Breilauer did it, all machines. We didn't have a live thing on that. And I'm just trying to think. Jeffrey played Joe Cocker that I did.
Oh.
What
was that like?
I love Joe. He was just one of the most wonderful guys you'll ever meet, despite the reputation and what it appears. He was so sweet. He was just a sweetheart. So we recorded at the Village, where I did a lot of my work. And Jeffrey was playing, and I think Chuck was playing, whatever. And Joe doesn't write songs, so you always had to write the lyrics out for Joe. And he would sing it as if there were no lyrics there. He was one of the two best singers I ever worked with, he and Laura Nero. But Joe would have to read the lyrics. I don't know, we were doing it for a little bit, and then Joe said, hey, can we take a few minutes? I just want to see my friends. And I said, yeah, sure. So Robbie Robertson had an office in the building, and we were all good friends. And Gary Busey was a friend of Joe's, and that was always going to be trouble. So he took a few minutes, and when he came back to, you know, work, he said, anybody see my lyrics? So, of course, now I have the second running around the Studio D in the Village looking for lyrics. It took a half hour, and the second found it under the ice tray in the freezer. You can only imagine how it got there.
And that was the session Jeff was on?
Jeffrey played that all those tracks with me and Joe. I just can't remember all the records. Jeffrey played a lot. Jeffrey played more tracks with me than anyone else. Purdy played tracks, but I'm trying to think. I don't know if Purdy played tracks for me other than with Donald. Jeffrey played lots of stuff.
He was, I'm sure you saw the fun side of Jeff too. I know you've alluded to that. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe you could share a funny anecdote of him.
Why not?
His fun side. No.
Well, for one thing, he was considerably younger than me. So I wasn't in and around that crowd indulging in the fun side with them. And, you know, it was L.A. in the 70s.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know, that should say enough.
For a fact that the night.
Although I will tell you, Jeffrey worked so much. He wasn't quite the guy who said, I better take this gig. It might be my last, as a lot of musicians are. He just was a professional. He had gigs. He wanted to play. And he liked, you know, he liked playing on records that people were going to hear. He called me one night, you know, around 12:01. He knows I'm up really late. And he said, hey, I cut a number one record tonight. And he knew when he was cutting hits. And he called and he said, you know, I'm sure I cut a number one record tonight. And it was with Lionel, you know, dancing on the walls or ceiling, whatever that song.
Yeah.
And
I remember he said, I did this thing with Lionel tonight. I'm sure it's going to be number one. So, you know, these guys just played.
Yeah.
It's not like they were hanging out a lot. And they had fun while they were playing.
Did he ever talk to you about the Ricky Lee Jones thing?
No, I fixed the Ricky Lee Jones thing with Lenny for him.
What do you mean?
Well, Jeffrey got that gig. Lenny Warnicka and I are very close friends. Actually, I'm 6 hours older than Lenny. But we became very good friends and still are. And when Lenny and I basically signed Ricky Lee, I would go to the office every day before I'd go to the studio just to hang out. And in the morning at like 11 o'clock, only Lenny and I were there. You know, Titleman was at his studio and Templeman at his and so forth. But Lenny and I would come to the office and just shoot the shit for an hour. And he said, hey, come listen to this. And he played me, you know, Chucky. And I said, oh, that's a really good song. And then he played me Last Chance Texaco, which I don't know if you can see, but I bought a lithograph of the Last Texaco station on Route 66. And we signed her that day. So I became a little bit of the Ricky Lee world.
Okay.
Then she came to New York to do Saturday Night Live, and Lenny hates to travel.
Okay.
So he called me, said, would you go to the show? They were my friends anyhow. Would you go to the show and mix her thing? I did it for her and Randy when he would come. And so through all of that, they knew Jeffrey was my favorite drummer, and they loved the Steely records. So Lenny, who had not worked with Jeff, he worked a lot with Jim.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they hired Jeffrey to do these dates. So they're recording, and Ricky Lee's doing a stretch, and Jeffrey's playing. And every time they get to this one spot, Ricky was a mess, having fun. And she would yell in the phone, you know, in the mic.
Well, I know the story.
Jeffrey, there's a fill. And, you know, okay, it happened once, and Jeffrey would play a fill and whatever. They did another take, and the same thing would happen. They did another take, and the same thing would happen until Jeffrey, who was never best, would say, hey, Ricky, you don't have to tell me anymore. I know where the fill is. Next take, same thing. Jeffrey couldn't take it. He took the sticks, put them through the snare, and left the building.
Yep.
And so she called Lenny and said, I want you to report Jeffrey to the studio. He walked out, and I had all these musicians there. I want you to report him to the union. Mm-hmm. So Lenny called me, talked to Jeffrey. And I told Lenny, Lenny and I both agreed, if one person reports Jeffrey to the union, she'll never see a musician in L.A. again. She needs to know. You can be angry. You can call Jeffrey if you want. If you report him, you've done your last date in L.A. with musicians. And so Lenny and I sat and talked to her for an hour, and she didn't do it.
Wow.
Really?
Yes.
What did you say to her?
You can't do that. Exactly what we, Lenny told her exactly what I just said to you. No one will play.
You can't do that because he.
No one will play for you in L.A. if you report Jeffrey.
Because he's popular.
Because
the solidarity.
He's a popular guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, see, I never heard that part of the story.
The next book, Robin, there's a story for the next book right there, thanks to Gary Katz.
Wow.
That'd be true.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, the whole
Lenny had a, and no, I, and I have, I like Ricky. I mean, I don't, first of all, I'm a big fan. She's a fabulous artist.
He was a mess in those days.
But she's a fabulous artist. And knew what she wanted. And that just was going to be the wrong thing for her to do in L.A. So Lenny talked to her about that.
And Gary, they worked together again after that, right? Didn't I remember reading Jeff,
Jeff with you, Robin? I mean, all of this came from Jeff's mouth. I have the story in the first book.
Exactly.
And then the end of the story that I have, of course, is Jeff telling me that a couple years later, or a few years later, when she made her next album, she was straight.
Yeah.
And he got called to play the album. And she didn't have any recollection of what had happened. And
probably Jeffrey, too.
He walks in and she says, oh, Jeff, it's so great to see you. Oh, you look like you lost weight.
Yeah.
And for a minute, he thought she was messing with him because he had actually gained weight. That's where the story ends. But he played and it went great. And that's what I have.
Yeah. Boy, life and show business.
Yeah.
Music world, L.A., 70s.
Yeah.
Different kind of time.
Man.
Wow. I never knew the part. I'm glad I asked that question.
No, Lenny and I talked a lot. And, you know, I spoke with Jeffrey and whatever. And Lenny just said, you know, you can't do that.
But you did talk to Jeff.
I talk to Jeff most days.
I mean, you talked to Jeffrey about the incident.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Well,
you know, I want to repeat what he said. It was a difficult day for everybody.
I've had to defend, the rumors on you know, social media make me crazy. And so I end up trolling and getting involved and having to tell people that they're out of their minds and it didn't happen that way, and go read my first book because it's all in there in his words.
Exactly. Yeah. Gary, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Gary.
No, it's true. I mean, Jeffrey would tell you what it is. Ask him a question, he would tell you.
Yep.
Yeah. I was just going to say, Gary, a few people watching have commented that a couple of records you produced that Jeff played on, Love and Money and 10cc Meanwhile. that you produced with. So I don't know if that rings any bells or anything. You
talk about that Love and Money. I like that.
Yeah.
It was great. Three good friends of mine from Scotland who were terrific. We went to Ocean's Way, came out to L.A. and spent the summer in Malibu, which wasn't so bad. And Jeffrey played the record at Ocean's Way. It was a lot of fun. He liked the guys a lot. And it's a terrific record. Terrific. Really great artist.
Do you remember, do you have a recollection, Gary? And again, this goes back a long time, but when he would come in for a session, did he generally bring the same drum kit gear-wise, or did he focus, if he knew he was doing a record that was...
You know, JR would bring his drums to the studio.
Yeah, J-Mo, yeah.
So there was never... Nobody ever asked about drums or which drum. J-Mo always came with the drums.
Yeah. Okay.
But I did do it. We did work. David and Jeffrey came to Woodstock with me, and we did an album with an Irish artist named Paul Brady, who's terrific.
Yeah.
And and I'm pretty sure I rented beer in Woodstock for him. He didn't travel with it. Mm-hmm. And the times in New York, he didn't travel. I would rent stuff for him. Either he would go to, you know, SIR or Carol, or he had a kit he liked and they would send it over.
Yeah. And I get the sense that he knew what he liked, but he could make anything if the rental kit, if it was an A&R studios and there was a house kit, he could make that work like Gad would do.
All those guys can do that. Yeah. I'm sure Jim can do that. They all do that because they run into situations, you know, once in a while that it's not ideal and something like that'll happen. They all know how to fend.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I have no doubt about that.
Yeah.
I never saw Jeffrey in a state where, like, what am I going to do? Never.
And He was sort of in the early stages of producing records, kind of toward the end there.
I don't know much about that part of what he did. You know, making Toto records, they were all producing. I'm sure Jeffrey was a distinctive voice in the room, so I'm sure he was doing that with David and the guys. I mean, you know, Luke produced their own records.
Yeah.
From what I heard, that was sort of his next chapter.
He had a problem with his wrist.
Yeah, and he did produce one record with some buddies of his called The Strand, which is in the new book, a chapter in the new book. That was his thought.
Well, he was, like I said, he was having problems with his wrist.
Yeah.
He knew it wasn't going to last long.
Mm-hmm. And really, he was sort of a producer in the sessions.
When you put a drum track down, he's creating the style of that record.
And even Larry Carlton... And one of the readers said to me they were really amused by one of the stories because Bill LeBounty said that on a session he was sort of directing Jeff, and Larry Carlton had to pull him aside and say, you know, even on my sessions, I don't direct him. Jeff,
I directed him in the midst of takes.
Jeff is, Larry said, Jeff is sort of the final word.
Yes.
If Jeff says something, we sort of defer to Jeff. And that was even Larry Carlton telling Bill.
But to be fair, and that's definitely true about Jeffrey, all the great drummers, you could say that about. like when Purdy played or Jim played, what they played in a given track, they set the tone for that track. That's what the track was going to be, was what they played. Mm-hmm. And we appreciated that. We weren't drummers, and we didn't want to have to do that. We wanted someone like Jeffrey who came and said, yo, I got it.
Yeah. And well, that's kind of where I was going. Yeah. With that question, Gary, because I, like you said, Robin, that was going to be the next, you know, I remember Keltner talking about this too. The next step for Jeff would be producing, because it sounds like, even like you said, Gary, in all these early sessions, he had a vision. He had a producer's mind in terms of, and that's, you know, that's not just something anybody can do.
No, the great musicians, Jeffrey was definitely a great musician, but Jeffrey and Jim and Purdy and Marauder, they heard the record as they were playing. Mm. They're playing first.
Right.
It's a great talent. You know, we required that. We didn't know how to play drums. You know, Walter could talk to Chuck about a bass, and Donald could talk to someone about a keyboard part, but we were stuck when we came to drums. So hired the good guys.
And you did, man. You sure did.
It doesn't take much more to hire the good guys than not the good guys.
Right. That's true.
Yeah, mother used to say, it's just as easy to marry a rich man as it is a not a rich man. And
except with the guys I played with, I went home alone.
Can I ask you, Gary, in terms of, like, you know, Steely Dan had the greatest engineers, absolutely. And the sound that you got out of his drums, did he ever say, geez, I'd love it if you could get, no. I mean, it was like and all the guys basically live with the sound. That's.
You know, I go through 20 minutes with him of tighten the snare. No, let's not tighten the snare. The toms don't sound quite as compatible with what we just got the snare sound. We would do that for 20 minutes and we were done.
Yeah. Yeah. And obviously you had a great sound in those 20 minutes. It was. Yeah.
And, you know, I worked with Roger Nichols and Elliot Shiner.
Yeah, yeah.
Dream team.
Absolutely, yeah.
Who loved each other and made it easy. That's it. There was no competitive spirit between them. They appreciated what each one did and couldn't wait for them to do what they did to get back to what the other guy did. It was really fun to be around. And one other thing I can say that I don't know anyone can say, for all the years we played, and all the musicians and personalities that came in the room, but mainly just the core of us, I never heard an argument. I never heard anything resembling an argument or a loud sentence. Mm. Ever.
Yeah. Just total respect all the way around. Right?
Just, I mean, yeah. Fortunately, it was a group of people who sort of, obviously being totally different than each other, but all had that part of their personality. Never heard a loud word in the studio, even when we disagreed. It was never a loud word.
That's something. There's a great question from Rob Wallace. And Gary, I want to thank you again for being here, because I know you moved some things around to be
that's
here
okay.
today. Thank you so much. And I would love to have you in the future, and Robin too, but I would love to just pick your brain about all sorts of other things.
Yeah, he's Gary's the best.
Yeah, absolutely. But here's the question from Rob, which I think is a great one. How did Jeff approach a new song if there was no chart? Would he zero in on vocals or melody or the groove?
Donald would sit in the room and he'd play it.
So
Donald would sit at the piano.
Yep.
Asian, there was a demo, but rarely. Donald would play it. There was Chuck in the room. I'm saying as often there was Chuck in the room and Paul Griffin and Donald playing and Jeffrey. And as the guys started to play it, Jeffrey would start playing a groove. I know it sounds basic, but that's what we did.
Yeah, no, I believe it.
I didn't want them to ask me what to play. They were better than we were at that.
And that's what made him special, is he knew the right thing to play instinctively. He just,
great drummers do that.
Yeah, yeah.
I shouldn't say that. There were some really great drummers. The people I worked with were great and were able to do that. And why we worked with them, because we weren't able to fill that in if they didn't.
Yeah, yeah.
Not that important.
There's lots of great stories in the book about his incredible time and his ability to play a pre-recorded track with no click track and overdub drums, which is just, you know, there are a few counts of that in the book too. And did you have an experience with that, Gary?
All the time.
I'm sorry, say that again?
He didn't love his time.
He didn't love his time, right. I know.
Now, and by the way, he wasn't wrong at sometimes. Sometimes it was okay. Sometimes we again.
And you guys didn't use click tracks.
Oh, yes, we did.
You did, but not on everything, though.
Pretty much everything.
You did.
Yeah. We wanted the guys to. The one thing that Donald, the only thing Donald cared about, only, was a steady drum track. That's why there's a Wendell. And that we couldn't get Hey 19.
Yeah.
And we were in the room and Donald turned to Roger and said, can't you build a fucking machine that'll give me a steady drum track? And Roger said, yeah, give me the money and time and I'll go do it. And he did.
Yeah, the Wendell.
It's the only thing Donald cared about. You could play a bad note or whatever. Only care about a steady drum track. So yes, we used click tracks.
Yeah.
Time. I can't think of a time we didn't.
Really? Okay.
And it's funny because
we would always get pushback from Purdy.
Well, I'm surprised not Jeff. Steve Picaro said Jeffrey hated a click track. Hated.
It's okay. If he hated it, he didn't show it to us and he was just fine. So couldn't do it without a click track. Not for what Donald wanted. It was impossible.
Yeah.
So, not every track was a click track. And Purdy, no matter how many times he would sit there, he'd say, you know, I'm the click track.
Right.
He was close to being right than anybody else. Much more than anybody else, he was a click track. But even he, we made use a click track. Was it Donald?
Mm. Well, there's a story about Jeff recording Bonnie Raitt's "Luck of the Draw," the song from that record, and I'm sure you know it, Gary.
And Paul Brady wrote that.
Yes, yeah, of course, that's right, and you know the great Ricky Vitar, I guess, just it's such an amazing song, and I've always loved that song. I didn't know the backstory.
Do you know, Gary, that Paul, until he and I spoke, never knew that Jeff ended up on that track?
What do you mean? Jeffrey was stuck with us.
No, he didn't. He didn't know that Jeffrey ended up on.
Oh, Luck of the Draw.
Luck of the Draw. Yeah. Yeah. He assumed it was Ricky. Yeah.
Paul. Record we did that I love.
He worked with Jeff on that album that you did with him, but he never knew that was Jeff on the Bonnie Raitt track until he and I talked. He was stunned. He said, well, I guess he figured out how to work with me on the Woodstock project.
We had a lot of fun. It was, you know, David and Jeffrey and Landau and Rainey. It was a good band. And Paul, who's a very good guitar player. It was a really good band and a fun record to make. Fun record.
Yeah.
And I got to meet Bonnie, who I didn't know. When she came in to sing at the Village, she said, well, it was me, Paul, and her husband, who was Michael O'Keefe at the time. the actor.
Ah.
He said, I think you're the only person in the room who hasn't seen me naked.
Oh! Okay.
That's how I met Bonnie.
I don't know whether I want to know what that means.
It was a good introduction, and she sang like Bonnie. And I listened to that track just so I can hear Bonnie, actually. She's just great.
Yeah. Do you guys mind if I play a little bit of Luck of the Draw?
No.
Go.
This is a beautiful song with Jeff on drums. Title track from the album Luck of the Draw, 1991.
So this is Jeff in Woodstock with Rainey doing Paul Brady.
Pull it over to the, yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Look at that.
So I would say Jeffrey probably recorded that track with her playing. He did it live with her. I could be wrong. I have no idea. But I don't know how you would do that particular track the way she does it.
Yeah. And
unless he played live with her, because that's not a steady guitar track.
No, I know. I know. And that's why when it's when I read that the drums were overdubbed, it's superhuman. And, you know, he certainly had those abilities. But yeah, that's it's such, you know, it just it's always sounded to me like they're all in the room together, and or he was there with Bonnie or mm-hmm. if it was Hutch playing bass.
Yeah.
It's a just a gorgeous guitar. Track.
Yeah. She's definitely playing guitar.
So many great songs, but I'm going to play something that is kind of, to me, the opposite of that last song in terms of just, it's Jeff really kind of just kind of throwing down, as they say, but, Forever Man, Clapton.
How many times must I tell you, baby? How many bridges I got to cross? How many times must I explain myself? Or I can talk to the boss. Or I can talk to the boss. How many times must I say I love you? Oh, you finally understand. Won't you be my forever woman? I'll try to be your forever man. I'll try to be your forever man.
God, that song. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Man.
Listen, anyone likes that. There's nothing to know except how do you want me to end it? It's just like, it, you know, it's a straight ahead groove.
Yeah. But, you know, and Gary, I don't have to tell you this, but he played with such conviction. You know, to me, that song, the first time I heard that in the radio, the summer of 1985, I didn't know it was Jeff until I bought the record. And I thought it was Jamie Oldacre, who was Clapton's drummer at the time. And I love Jamie, rest his soul. But man, when I found out it was Jeff, it made perfect sense because it had that, you know, all of a sudden I started hearing familiar things that, you know, from listening to Jeff. And there's just such
conviction. How do you want it to end?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that-
yeah. Right. Wouldn't you say that there was such a confidence in his playing.
He got up in the morning confident. There was never an issue about that.
Yeah.
Never. No. None of those guys.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know Purdy.
But a little bit, yeah. Yeah. So,
confidence?
More than understand the word confidence. All those guys. And the reason is because they know they can do this.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they don't have to think anything themselves other than, I can do this.
Yeah. Yeah.
They just definitely never worried, except if it was a shuffle. But he was never worried about anything to play. And I'm sure he didn't do that shuffle shit with other people. He just does.
Yeah, that little halftime, you know, and it's, we hear it a couple of years later. I'll just quickly, this Toto song, we kind of, Stop Loving You from 88. I don't know why it's not louder.
I don't know when Del Big the Blow came out. You remember that track, Poison?
Yes.
Yeah. That, no, seriously. That he would call me every night. He said, listen to this. And he incorporated that into his psyche. As time went by, he loved that dude, and so did I. It turned out to be sort of like a precursor to hip-hop beats that were cool.
Interesting, yeah.
He was infatuated with that one, but that beat.
Wow. Well, I'm gonna just play a couple more little things, and we can wrap it up. But I want to thank you again, Gary. Is there anything else that comes to mind that you want to share with the folks watching?
I wish things came to mind these days. No, I don't. Whatever you want to know, I'll tell you, but you have to ask me.
I appreciate that. No, this has been incredible having you here and sharing these stories. And, you know, I'll have you on another time, and I'll have more things to pick your brain with, I promise. But
it's going rapidly, so get there soon.
You know, maybe we could even do something, and not to get into it now, but I could get Rick Marotta and Jim Keltner to come on, and maybe even Bernard, and all of us could pick your brains. But your brain.
Good luck with the Mets.
Yeah, well, that's another, right, that's another story. But I'm going to play a little bit of a few songs before we close out here. And
okay.
This is just a beautiful ballad.
All that I so wanna give you, babe.
His choices, I'll say it again, he just always knew the exact most beautiful thing to play. And here's an example of Jeff not being able to play a shuffle, as he so modestly put it.
What's cool about the Boz records, and even Lowdown more than this, is they knew to fix the drum groove valve.
Yeah, yeah. Is. Yep.
Especially love.
Yes, yep. Just long enough to grab a handle off the top. Next stop, Chi-Town, Leo, put the money down and let him roll. He said, one more job ought to get it. One last shot, no quit it. One for the road.
Yeah, man. Because he told me he couldn't figure out how to make the beat really work, so he added a second hi-hat. There were two hi-hats there.
Yeah, yep. He overdubbed the 16th note hi-hat part. Yeah.
That's what happened.
Yeah. Babies in the running round. Wow.
Putting your business in the crowd. Talking out loud. Same
bottom. I mean, it's just his execution, his precision.
You better bring the chick around.
Amazing. Dirty load down.
I'm sorry, Gary?
Amazing, considering the fun he used to like to have.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he was just such a natural, man.
Give that big idea.
All right, I'm going to close with a. Nothing you ain't got. And I'm going to play this last song. I think you'll recognize this, Gary.
Sure. That was fun.
Oh, man. Jeff can play that groove with one hand tied behind his back.
Amazing.
And he did. Gary, thank you so much for being here. And Robin, thank you so much for being here. I want to one more time mention this great book that is out right now.
Definitely.
Robin Flynn's Moments in Time with the foreword by Gary Katz. Jeff Beccaro's story is available on Hudson Music's website, on sale this week, today and all week. And if you haven't picked up Robin's first book from 2020, It's About Time. Jeff Beccaro, the man in his music.
Jeffrey's 70th birthday.
On Jeffrey's 70th birthday.
Today.
Yeah.
Would he have done all these years? Wow. Can't even imagine.
I can't even begin to imagine what the last 30 years, the amount of music he would have, great music he would have made and probably produced.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I really thank you for having me. And Gary, thank you for coming in.
Fun. This was fun. And anytime you want to do something, just, you know, let me know.
I will. I absolutely will, Gary. Thank you. Thank you. All right, I'm going to end the stream. Thanks for watching, everybody. A big hand for my guests, Robin Flynn, the legendary Gary Katz, and happy birthday to our hero, Jeff Beccaro. We love and miss him every
day. Happy birthday to my good friend, Jeff, and our good friend, Harvey, whose birthday we all shared a year together.
Oh.
Happy birthday.
All right.
Two April Fool's friends of mine.
Huh.
Happy birthday. Yeah.
Happy birthday, Jeff. Thanks again. Fun. Let me know if you want to do something. I'm around.
I will. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay. Bye, guys.
All right, well, that's my show. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, give it a like, leave me a comment. Don't forget to subscribe to my YouTube channel if you haven't done that already. And the podcast is available on all the podcast platforms, so download it. And remember, no drummers are ever harmed on Live From My Drum Room or Track Talk. And drummers, when in doubt, leave it out. All right. Again, thanks for watching. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you again real soon. See ya.